Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James here with Pastor William Fink for another installation here of Christogenos, our ongoing discussion. Primarily, we've been discussing two seed line and related issues. We've been looking in the book of Daniel, and this should be our last episode of the book of Daniel. We're on middle of chapter 11, but before we continue with chapter 11, Bill wants to do a couple of updates. Bill, why don't you take it?
Yeah, praise Yahweh. I was looking back at, after our discussion last week on Daniel 11, 5, and 6, and so forth. And I would insist, and I still do, that this prophecy transcends greatly the Syrian wars between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids.
Okay.
Okay. And I was reading the NAB today version. And it's very different from the King James in a lot of places.
Oh, now what's the MAB?
NAB, it's the New American Bible.
Okay.
And it's not, you know, a lot of its renderings are much better than the King James version.
Okay.
Because they're a lot clearer. And I don't know if they're more accurate Hebrew, and I know a lot of their clearer renderings in the New Testament aren't always more accurate Greek, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the Bible, and it's the same scholarship. Yeah, you know, it's the same universal scholarship that's crept into Christianity for 400 years now, probably, or better.
Right.
And it's not superior in that respect. But I'd like to read a couple of passages from that and compare them to some things in history. And I don't know enough of the history in the Middle Ages to give a precise interpretation of Revelation chapter 11 all the way through.
Okay.
However, if certain anchor points are very clear, which I believe they are, that warrants further inspection.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that, of course, that's a very time-consuming procedure.
Yeah.
I'm going to start with 11:5 from the NAB. The king of the south shall grow strong, but one of his princes shall grow stronger and still, and govern a domain greater than his. Well, which is quite different from the AB. And I'd say that this seems to describe the Ptolemies,
mm-hmm.
because it's a much more conservative translation than the King James at 11:5, I believe.
The King James says his dominion shall be a great dominion, where the one you just read says shall be greater.
But the King James makes it seem like it's going to be like much more magnified.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? That's the visual picture I get when I read the King James.
Okay. Okay.
And this is just simply factual. Grow stronger still and govern a domain greater than his. And this seems to describe the Ptolemies. They took the coast of Syria from the Seleucids and parts of southern Anatolia and a few of the islands, which isn't any big thing on the scale of Alexander's empire or the Roman Empire, okay? But mm-hmm. it is a domain greater than his father's.
Okay.
Okay? And while none of their territorial gains were ever truly secure or enduring, this must fit, if verse 6 describes Cleopatra 7. And I'm going to read verse 6 from the NAB. After some years, they shall become allies, meaning the king of the north and the king of the south.
Right.
Now, by the time of Cleopatra, the king of the north has a much different character. It's not a Greek kingdom now, it's a Roman one.
Okay. Right.
The daughter of the king of the south, which Cleopatra inherited the throne from her fathers, shall come to the king of the north in the interest of peace. And Cleopatra had affairs with Mark Antony and Julius Caesar.
Right.
And they were both kings of the north at one, at the same time, actually.
Right.
But her bid for power shall fail, and her line shall not be recognized, and she shall be given up together with those who brought her son and her husband.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, to me, this describes Cleopatra VII, who's the famous Cleopatra, and she actually is the seventh.
Okay.
Perfectly. She originally shared power with her father, who's mentioned here.
Mm-hmm.
With her father was Ptolemy 12 Oletes, and with her brothers, Ptolemy 13 and 14,
mm-hmm.
whom she was married to.
Okay.
Okay? She was a real whore.
Right.
But she herself eventually gained sole rule. And the Ptolemies were taking the title pharaoh, which she took.
Yeah.
And she consummated a liaison with Julius Caesar, and that solidified her position on the throne. And later she elevated her son to be co-ruler in her name.
Okay.
And her son is mentioned here,
mm-hmm.
and her husband is mentioned here, and they're all rulers with her at one time or another.
Okay.
And she, she her dominion was destroyed. It was lost at the Battle of Actium.
Yeah, right.
When her and Antony had the civil war with Octavius or Caesar, the famous Augustus.
Mm-hmm.
So that all makes perfect sense to me.
Right, right. Well, I quoted. I don't have Howard B. Rand's book in front of me. He talks about that as being a different Queen of the South. And I went into that last week, and I should...
Well, right, it's Berenice.
Okay, right.
But none of that, Berenice, her heirs inherited her position.
Mm-hmm.
Her line stayed.
Yeah.
And this says that, and she shall be given up together with those who brought her son and her husband.
Okay.
And that fits Cleopatra VII a hell of a lot better.
Okay.
As far as I'm concerned,
yeah,
and that also pushes the rest of this prophecy outside of the into the scope of greater history,
right.
and what I believe to be the struggle between the King of the South is a struggle that and the King of the North transcends greatly
right. Sure.
the struggle between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids,
mm-hmm.
and goes much further in time, and that makes a lot more
right.
sense.
Yeah,
and now. If this detail, and Fowler tries to say that all the way down to Daniel 11:30 is the struggle between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies.
Okay.
And I can't see it being that detailed and then skip all the way to the setting up of the abomination of desolation in verse 31.
Okay.
And not have anything in all that detail in 30 verses
mm-hmm.
about the Maccabees, about... Yeah. The independence that outside of the rule of the kings of the north and the kings of the south,
yeah.
that Judea gets for 110 years,
mm-hmm.
or I'm sorry, let me see, 156 to 70 maybe. So maybe it's 80 years or 90 years, but it's still a long period of time
right.
that they were independent, and that isn't even alluded to here. It's not even part of the picture, and that's
right.
why it's not part of the picture.
Well, I'm going to be continuing to, because Rand puts it all in that historical period, okay? And I remember last time we were discussing this pretty much at length, and it seems to me that both prophecies really work. they both work, and it's a very frequent in prophecy that you have a short-term solution and a long-term solution, okay? So I'm going to pursue that, from Daniel 11:17, okay? Do you have any more, because I think you mentioned Richard the Lionheart being a fulfillment of one of these verses.
Right. It seems to me that from verse 7 forward that this section seems to, and I don't have the historical detail to reveal it.
Mm-hmm.
However, it seems to represent the struggles between the Islamic world and the Roman and Byzantine world.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And to go to 14, in those times many shall resist the king of the south and outlaws of your people, or as the King James puts it,
robbers.
And robbers of your people
mm-hmm.
shall rise up and in fulfillment or to fulfill the vision, and they shall fail. And that seems to me to indicate the popes who wanted conquest. Well, which they said was in the name of Christ, but was really in the name of greed.
Sure.
To establish the vision of the kingdom.
In the name of universalism, right.
Well, right, that too. To establish the vision of the kingdom was their vision of the kingdom, that Christ would rule, or rather that they would be able to loot and pillage the whole world.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to point to the Crusades. And verse 15, when the king of the north comes, he shall set up siege works and take the fortified city by storm. The power of the south shall not withstand him. Not even his picked troops shall have strength to resist. That seems to me to describe the first crusade, when the
okay.
the Europeans were did have much success and actually set up four kingdoms in what was territory that the Muslims had taken, and one of those kingdoms was Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And they were actually feudal kingdoms and not Catholic kingdoms, which really upset the Pope.
Right.
He didn't foresee that.
Yeah, well, yeah, the Knights Templar emerged from all of that, and they became the adversaries of the papacy. So even though the Crusades were begun by the popes, they turned out to work against them. Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Now the NAB translates verse 17 quite different. He shall set himself to penetrate the entire strength of this kingdom. He shall conclude an agreement with him and give him a daughter in marriage to destroy the kingdom. I don't know where they get those words from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like I said, it's not always good, the NAB.
Well, yeah, it's interpretation.
well, right. But there's two words there that aren't in the other versions, and that's that second occurrence of the words the kingdom.
Uh-huh.
And the King James says, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him, thus he shall do, and he shall give him the daughter of women corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. And then I'm going to read verse 18.
Okay.
After this, he shall turn his face unto the isles and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. And let me say that this, to me, perfectly describes Richard the Lionheart.
Okay.
And if this is talking about the Middle Ages and the struggles between the North and the South, Richard the Lionheart fits into this
right
like a glove.
Okay.
Because he actually offered his own sister to make a treaty with Saladin. He offered his own sister's hand in marriage to get temporary control of Jerusalem.
Right.
After he had taken a lot of the Palestinian coast in and around Acre, what, you know, I don't know the pronunciation.
Right.
Acre is the name of the town, and it's on the coast opposite Jerusalem.
Right.
Now, he had also taken Cyprus, and he sold it to a French nobleman. And after he finished all this, he ended up in prison, because on the way back to England, he was shipwrecked.
Okay.
And ended up in on the shores of land controlled by Henry V in Europe.
Right.
And Henry V locked him up and held him for ransom.
Right. Okay, I don't see the word shipwrecked in verse 18.
Well, no, but no, the word shipwreck isn't there, okay?
Yeah, right.
But a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease.
Okay.
And that, to me, tells me that, you know, this Henry, that fits into Henry V taking him captive, which causes Richard's endeavors to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually held him for ransom. Now, we held him for ransom until England paid a ransom.
Okay.
And I believe that's the raiser of taxes that stood up in his estate.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay, in verse 20. Okay, because they had to raise taxes in England to pay Henry V off to free their king.
Right.
And they did it. And Richard goes back, Richard the Lionheart goes back to England, okay, and gets reincarnated a second time.
Yeah.
In order to he had a second coronation ceremony in order to seal his control, you know, to reestablish his control because he had been gone so long. And then he goes to his own land. Okay.
Yeah.
But and this is what it says. He shall turn his face, you know, toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found.
Uh-huh.
And he goes back to France right after his reincarnation in England. He goes back to France because his rule there he's a Norman king.
Uh-huh.
He's the third or fourth line from descent from William the Conqueror. And he still has control of at least part of Normandy in France.
Yeah.
And that control is being challenged, so he goes back to fight for it, and he dies in battle there.
Yeah, okay. All right, yeah, well, as I said, there could be a short-term fulfillment and a long-term fulfillment, and you know, the picture you're painting really does fit well with these verses, no doubt about it. I'm going to repaste the link to this website, which interprets this. It's pretty much a continuation of Howard B. Rand's scenario, because Howard B. Rand drops the ball at approximately verse 20 in his discussion of Daniel 11, okay? And just simply doesn't talk about it again in his book, okay? But this particular website, if people want to click on it, pretty much continues what he started in his book, Study in Daniel. okay? And, you know, if you have a bit more to say about these before I, you know, continue, you know, please go ahead. Otherwise, I'll switch to this article here.
Well, all right. I think that the next part, Dan, you know, 1121, might describe Frederick the Great and the relationship between Frederick and Pope Gregory.
Okay.
And where it says that he whom the royal insignia shall not be given, well, Gregory actually excommunicated Frederick.
Uh-huh.
Frederick too.
Oh, okay.
And Frederick too, who actually valued commerce with Muslims, went off on conquest in Jerusalem,
right.
Crowned himself the king of Jerusalem for a time, came back, had a battle with Gregory, and finally they kissed and made up.
Uh-huh.
And it says that he would gain the kingdom deceitfully.
Right.
And
it just says here in the King James.
It doesn't have quite the clarity that the you know that the previous section seems to fit Richard.
Yeah.
But it's still.
Yeah, it's close. It's very close. Yeah.
It still seems to fit.
Well, here,
okay.
Let me bring everybody up to speed on the Ptolemaic versus Seleucid interpretation that seems to be fairly common, and Howard B. Rand was obviously a proponent of it, okay? I was going to back up just as a refresher from last show. Apparently, verse 12, and we're talking about chapter 11 here, apparently verse 12 is about Ptolemy 4. Verse 13 is about Antiochus 3, the Great. Verse 14, Philip of Macedon and, let's see, it says, Judahite mercenaries assisted Antiochus in his campaign against Egypt. So we're still talking about Antiochus 3. And Antiochus 3 is the subject in up to many verses here. So let me just go to verse 17, which talks about he shall also set his face to enter with strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so according to this author, verse 17, Antiochus III the Great intends to take all of Egypt, but tries subterfuge first by giving his daughter. He intended to prosecute his successes toward all of Egypt, and he used the Judahites, not the Jews, in his army. To save his armies for fighting Rome, he sends Cleopatra I of Syria to Epiphanes with a dowry. Fact number three, Cleopatra chose to love her husband Ptolemy V instead, turning against her father, Antiochus III. I think I covered that from Howard Rand last time. Okay. Now, verse 18, I think this is where we left off last time. But now, verse 18, let's read. After this, he shall turn. Again, we're talking now about Antiochus III. After this, he shall turn his face to the isles and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. And this is the interpretation on this website here. Number one, Antiochus raised reproaches against Rome to secure allies and assistance in defeating them. He took many islands of the Mediterranean and Aegean with 100 large ships and 200 small ones. Fact number three, but the Roman consul Lucius Scipio Asiaticus performed valiantly for his own glory and victory. Antiochus' incursions against the Romans were turned on him in defeat and total reparations. Fact number five, he was forced to pay for the Roman war costs at the rate of about 1,000 talents per year for 12 years. Okay, so this is pretty much a continuation of Howard B. Rand's analysis, and you stopped at verse 21, right? So let me just bring us up to speed on this interpretation. Verse 19, then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So verse 19, he returned to the safety of Syria, but his own countrymen killed him for the public burden he caused. Fact number one, he left the Romans in shame. He himself had to be in shame, which had defeated him with a small army and made him pay for it. Number two, he who was named great, Antiochus III, was assassinated for trying to plunder a pagan temple. Okay, verse 20, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Okay, so verse 20, Seleucus IV Philopater makes great efforts to pay the Romans and dies after a short reign. Seleucus Philopater was the oldest son of Antiochus III and very greedy and covetous. He spent much time raising taxes to pay 1,000 talents a year to Rome for his father's defeat. So the debt was passed on to Philopater. Fact number three, he was assassinated in treachery by Heliodorus, who sought to be king with Epiphanes in Rome. And finally, 3 Maccabees 3:7 and 9:23 indicate Seleucus sent Heliodorus to raid the temple treasures in Jerusalem. Okay, so this is all putting this history, these prophecies, in the days of the Maccabees. Okay, so now you went as far as verse 21. Now, according to this author, we're talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus IV Epiphanes, a profane man, took the Seleucid throne by outside assistance and flattery. Let's quote the King James. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of verse 21. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Okay, that's where you left off. And here are the 6 facts that this author presents with respect to Antiochus IV Epiphanes. He was in Rome as a hostage since his father's defeat, while the 1,000 annual tax was collected. He may have been involved in the treacherous assassination of his brother Seleucus IV Philopater. Number 3, the nation did not give him the throne as they saw it belonged to Demetrius, son of Seleucus IV. He used Eumenes and Attalus of Pergamos to assist him in taking the kingdom for his nephew. He flattered the populace as he had seen in Rome with modern personal politicking for popularity. he was a campaigner. Number 6, he called himself Epiphanes, the illustrious, but others called him Epimanes, the madman. Okay. All right. Shall I continue with these, or do you have something for us for verse
20? Well, I don't have a lot of details in 22 and 23, except to say that Frederick II did go to Palestine with a very small number of people and was very successful.
Okay.
And that really upset the Pope that he was so successful.
Right, right.
With such a small army.
Right. Yeah. And again, these are very interesting scenarios that the short-term fulfillment and the long-term fulfillment seem to work pretty well. Okay. Well, let me continue here because this puts it all in the days of the Maccabees, right? Verse 22, and with the arms of a flood shall they be overflowed from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Now, let's see what he has to say about this. Verse 22. Antiochus IV Epiphanes used, and of course, this he titled himself the illustrious here, using foreign assistance from Pergamos, vanquished his opponent Heliodorus. Number 1, Antiochus could not have taken the kingdom without the assistance of Eumenes and Attalus. 2, he broke his opposition, including the rightful prince Demetrius I Soter, who reigned after him. And number 3, the covenant here refers to his flattering claim that he was protecting the throne for Demetrius, okay? So just like, you know, Democrats and Republicans claim to be protecting the government for democracy, right? And they trade flatteries or insults, as the case may be, all right? Verse 23, and after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. Okay, this author says, Antiochus made a league with Ptolemy IV Philometor, the son of Cleopatra I, then took some of Egypt. Number 1, Ptolemy VI was the nephew of Antiochus by virtue of his mother being his sister, Cleopatra I. And there was a lot of incest going on in those days, folks.
The ancient pharaohs had the tradition of marrying their sisters.
That's right.
And the Ptolemies, who were Greeks, and that was in the classical Greeks, that was looked down upon in the Greek classics.
Yeah, but once in Rome, you do as the Romans, right?
And in the tragic poets, they looked down upon that behavior.
Of course.
And the Ptolemies got the Greeks, and you're right. Once in Egypt, they did like the Egyptians.
That's right. To maintain power, they kept it in the family. Right. And, of course, they violated God's law by committing incest. Of course, they didn't have God's law, so they weren't concerned about it. Okay. And then number 2, he moved through Syria and Palestine into Egypt with a small but formidable force to seize it. Okay. So that's his interpretation. And I'll cite the author of this interpretation once I'm done. I don't want to lose my spot here on the screen. So verse 24, he shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do to that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. So let's see what we have historically here with Antiochus. Antiochus carefully and peaceably made great progress against Egypt with spoil and strategies. While Ptolemy Philometor was deceived into safety, Antiochus moved upon his fattest territories. Superior to all the Seleucid kings before him, Antiochus makes great progress toward all Egypt. One of his policies was liberal distribution of military spoil to buy the souls of nobles and generals and of course, soldiers. With crafty guile, he devised strategies against the strongholds of Egypt to take it easily if possible. This subtle form of conquest would last for a while until the time was ripe for an all-out assault. That's what the Jews are doing to America now, folks. And number six, we consider this his first assault upon Egypt, for we have biblical record of three separate assaults. Okay, so verse 25, unless you got more information here from your long-term interpretation, Bill, because I believe you ended with a commentary on verse 24.
No, go on.
Okay. All right,
it seems to me, I don't know, verse 24 seems to describe the last crusades of Louis the Ninth of France, but yeah. I can't. It's, you know, he did die in the process, but those crusades weren't really against the, you know, they were against the king of the south, but they weren't against Palestine.
Right.
He tried to go after Tunis.
Uh-huh.
And you know, they kept moving the, they moved the point, the entry point to Egypt and then to Tunis because they weren't doing good in the east.
Uh-huh.
And, And he died in, died in Tunis.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right, so verse 25, and he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. So Antiochus, four Epiphanes, we're talking about here still, attacks Egypt openly with a large force and defeats a large force of Ptolemy Philometor. Number one, having had great success with his modest devices and scouting of Egypt, he attacks it openly. Young Ptolemy Philometor is defeated, not by military strength, but by treason through Antiochus. Verse 26, yea, that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. Young Ptolemy IV Philometor is defeated by internal sedition and treason of his closest advisors. Okay, verse 27. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Verse 27, Ptolemy, now the captive of Antiochus, invites him to a great banquet at Memphis, subject to the Lord. I don't know what he means here, subject to the Lord. Probably Lord Antiochus, I don't know. Fact number one. Antiochus IV Epiphanes made great lies of his care for his nephew Ptolemy IV Philometor. Ptolemy lies to his uncle of thanks for his care while he plans to unite with Euergetes, his brother. Of course, this sounds like leagues and treaties that we have today.
Right, but I just it's hard for me to fill in the details from the Middle Ages.
Sure.
And I just don't have the history. I'm not a student of Middle Ages, of the history of the medieval period.
Yeah, well, up to the point that you've brought us so far, it's all very plausible and very fascinating, but you'd have to do a lot more study into the history of the Crusades and a little bit beyond, it looks like.
Well, right. To fill in the blank. And, you know, it talks about one of his advisors steering him in the wrong way, and it was Charles of Anjou who got Louis the Ninth to invade at Tunis. So there are sketchy historical details that might fit.
Yeah, yeah.
However, the problem I have with the close translation is all the talk of the covenant and in these verses. And to me, I would have to put that – I would want to put that in a new covenant perspective and not an old covenant perspective, because the old covenant has always – has already by Daniel's time, for the most part, pass.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Israel is already divorced.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Well, yeah,
really
the northern
is
house
not,
is. Yeah, the
there's really not a prince of the covenant, except in a new covenant context, because the remnant is only there to provide the altar for the new covenant.
Right, right. Yeah, the remnant of the house of Judah. Right.
Now, I would like to say that in verse 22, and even the prince of the covenant,
uh-huh.
that line is missing from the Septuagint manuscripts.
Really?
It's only in the Masoretic manuscript.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Interesting. Okay.
But it does mention the covenant again later on.
Uh-huh.
And it's
okay.
in all the manuscripts so far.
Yeah.
Though.
Okay. So what this author interprets it as the covenant, you know, between these various princes and not having anything to do with Messiah the prince.
Well, that's right. possible also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So, and so for the last phrase of verse 27, which said, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. And he says, fact number three, the end of either or both kingdoms is not yet, though Antiochus has a serious advantage presently. Okay, verse 28. Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant. Now we may be talking about...
Well, right. That seems not to support Rand's interpretation.
Well, the Holy Covenant, well, this would be when he attacks Israel, or the house of Judah, I would think. Anyway, we'll find out real quick. Let me start at verse 28, the first word here again. Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. So this author says, Antiochus IV Epiphanes returns to Syria, but stops on the way to desecrate and desolate Jerusalem. Fact number one, having had great military success in Egypt, he had much spoil to take with him back to Antioch. The Judahites, having heard a false rumor that Antiochus was dead, celebrated, which enraged him. Okay. Now, fact number three, he entered Jerusalem, slaying 80,000 of any age or sex, plundered the temple, and desecrated it. So this was his first visit to the city of Jerusalem. Okay, now verse 29. At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. So let's, what does that mean? Let's see. Antiochus returns 2 years later to prosecute an additional war against Egypt without former success. Fact number one, this is the third campaign against Egypt, the small, subtle, and the large and open, which he's referring back to verses 23 through 26. Antiochus returned to Egypt in God's timing, for a prophecy of 2,300 days was running, verse Daniel 8, 14 to 15. So keep that in mind. This is his interpretation of the 2,300 days, okay? Fact number three, this campaign was not as successful as the first two, for he was defeated by a mere Roman threat, okay? So verse 30, for the ships of Chittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So he shall do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. I can foresee what that means, but let's just take it here as this author tells us regarding verse 30. The Romans' naval embassage demanded that Antiochus return to Syria, so he punished Israel instead. Okay. Deep into Egypt, Antiochus is met by Roman ambassadors from the Senate demanding his exit. Ptolemy 6 Philometor and his brother Ptolemy 8 Euergetes had sought the assistance of Rome. The Roman ambassador Papilius Leonis drew a circle in the sand and demanded his withdrawal. Grieved horribly at the treatment by his former friend and the Roman ambassador, he is full of wrath. He intends to take out all his frustration, grief, and hate on the Judahites who were in his return path. He sends his general with 22,000 soldiers to desolate and desecrate the city until it is quite empty. He has friends among the apostates of that rebellious people who assist his overthrow of the religion. I'm just going to cite one more, verse 31, which is apparently... the following verses get into the Maccabees as the Judahites in control of Jerusalem at the time. So
right, and I would only say that the first where it says that the king of the north will return to his own land and his eyes will be against his own land. You know, when the Crusades ended, it wasn't much longer, and the Wars of the Reformation begun to be fought.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And the ships of Chittim going against the King of the South. You know, the Venetian, the sailors of Venice, the merchants of Venice launched wars against the Muslims and at sea for 100 years throughout the 16th century.
Yes, very interesting. Yeah, okay. Now, verse 31, an arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily. Now, the King James adds the word sacrifice here. Okay, and many authors I've read on this subject say, well, that word sacrifice isn't there, so let's see what we come up with here, but I'll read it anyway. And shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that makes desolate. So
now this is the problem I have with the short-range interpretation.
Okay.
And there's probably, it doesn't fit that well into the long-range interpretation either, and we're going to discuss that.
Uh-huh.
The short-range interpretation, the abomination which maketh desolate, was still in the future at Christ's time.
Right.
Because he spoke about it in Matthew 24:15-16.
Uh-huh.
That it was still to come.
Right.
Okay. Now, the wars between the Syrians and the Ptolemies only ran down to about 160-something B.C.
Uh-huh.
There were 6 Syrian wars identified by historians.
Right.
I think they run down to 168 B.C. or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Rome is the dominant force in the region after that.
Yeah.
Now the abomination which maketh desolate, well, I don't know how we want to interpret that. There's probably several ways to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you want to – I think that it might be the mosques.
Mosques, okay.
The mosques.
Yeah.
The mosques in
– Right, yeah, no doubt, yes.
Either the mosque in Jerusalem, and what if there's more than one abomination which makes it desolate? I don't know what makes – I don't know what creates a greater desolation in an Adamic land than a mosque.
Right. Well, let me give you my interpretation of this. You know, when I first read it, I felt it referred to actually the Edomites taking over the temple, and we can indirectly give Antiochus IV Epiphanes credit for that, for having created dissension among the Israelites themselves. Okay.
Well, right, but when Christ is talking in Matthew chapter 24, the Edomites had already long taken over the temple.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
And the abomination which make it desolate certainly seems to me to still be in his future.
Okay. Well, yeah, but if you interpret it as the Edomites being allowed into the temple, which was done under Herod, that would, you know, that's how I would interpret it as a historical, you know, just before, actually that would be just before the lifetime of Christ. Okay.
That would be 36 B.C.
Okay.
Is actually when Herod took over, when he got that kingship, and he appointed that first high priest that he pulled out of Babylon.
Yeah.
That was about 36 B.C.
Okay,
And that was 33 years before Christ was born.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, this is still in the future, okay? And as I said, it would be indirectly tied to what Antiochus IV Epiphanes did by causing strife and division among, you know, the people of the house of Judah. Because you could probably start talking about the Sadducees. Well, the Sadducees were more, they were Hellenizers, is what they were. So that's when the division between the Hellenizers and the traditionalists began among the Israelites of Judah, okay? So let me, from this point on, I'm just going to read the defining sentence. I'm not going to read all the points that this author gives, okay? But verse 31, Antiochus places an armed garrison in the city, forbids Jewish sacrifice, and sets up his abomination. That's his interpretation. Okay, now verse 32. Let's read. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. So as I was just saying, he created a division between the traditionalists and the future Hellenizers. Okay, so the Hellenizers became a faction. And I'm just going to read the first sentence from his interpretation here. Two factions in Israel appear, one friendly to Antiochus and the other committed to his destruction. Of course, that would be the traditionalists, the ones who try to preserve their race, religion, and culture, which is white, not Jewish. Okay. Verse 33, And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet shall they fall by the sword, and by flame, by captivity, and by spoil many days. So if this is talking about the Maccabees period, that's a perfect description. The author here says, the faithful Maccabees and others like them instructed many, but were destroyed by various means. And it could be because they were not practicing the law perfectly, okay, and therefore they weren't being protected by Yahweh as they would otherwise have been. Verse 34, now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help, but many shall cling to them with flatteries. Now he says, the faithful Maccabees and others like them, in their difficult war against the Seleucid foes, they had very small numbers and many seditious. Yes, it's just like our Democrats and Republicans today. Verse 35, and some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. So let's see what this author has to say about that. Some of the Maccabees and others fell victim to violent deaths until the time of the end approach. Fact number four. The time of the end here is the appointed duration of the Maccabean rule and suffering. Even if the time of the end is applied to the end of Israel as a nation, we now come to its last stage, at least the house of Judah in Palestine, okay, verse 6. The duration of the Maccabees was from Mattathias, 167 B.C., to Herod as king of Judea, 37 B.C. As you just pointed out, that's when, in the following year, Herod allowed the Edomites into the temple for the very first time. Before then, no Edomite was ever allowed into the temple, okay?
I don't remember that from Josephus. I mean, I know that the Edomites were folded into the religion and circumcised.
Mm-hmm. Right. I remember reading that passage in Josephus. It's definitely in there. Yeah. Okay. So verse 36, now he's talking about Herod the Great. Okay. So he thinks that the theme, now we brought down to this time, and now this author thinks we're talking about Herod the Great. Okay, verse 36. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against Yahweh, the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. So verse 36, according to this author, the Herods, very important in relation to Daniel's people, prospered until the indignation was done. He's got 39 facts to go along with that. Way too many to read here. Now, verse 37, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. So how does that apply to Herod? Let's see. Herod the Great was politically ambitious without regard for any real religion, sympathy, or authority. Now, very interestingly here, he says, fact number one, as an Edomite, circumcised by force with the rest of that subjected nation, he says he was a son of Abraham and Isaac, which the Pharisees also claimed.
Okay. And that's fly. You know, Herod's being a son of Abraham and Isaac flies in the face of Josephus.
Well,
and
right.
In the face of the New Testament.
Right. Well, but the Pharisees made the same claim. They said, we be Abraham's seed. Okay.
So, right, but that doesn't mean that...
That doesn't mean that they are, right. But they had Esau as their father, and Esau's father was Jacob, okay, and Isaac and Abraham. So, but that's the only basis that these Edomites have for being of Abraham, okay, thus making Jehovah the God of his fathers, which he did not regard at all. And that's true. He did not regard Jehovah or Yahweh at all. He, in fact, built Caesarea and honored all kinds of, you know, Roman gods, Edomite gods, etc.
Well, right, it was a big sycophant for the Romans.
Yes, yes, okay.
And he taxed the people and built marvelous Roman works on the backs of the people.
Yeah, so verse 38, but in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. So here we have Herod the Great honored the Roman Empire and its rulers to get the necessary backing for his ambitions. Okay, that's very true. Verse 39, thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. So let's see what he says here about Herod. Herod built great strongholds and promoted the glory of the Romans in Palestine for his own ends. And then he divided the true Judahites in the same way. Okay, so next he says that these verses from verse 40 are talking about Caesar Augustus. Okay, verse 40. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into countries, and he shall overflow and pass over. The final end of the Greek kingdoms is brought about by the battle of Actium of Antony and Octavian. Okay, verse 41. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. So according to this commentator, Octavian entered Israel and countries of the east that were independent and under Antony's legal power. Okay. Verse 42, he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Octavian was successful in securing the countries of the king of the south, including Egypt. But the king of the south was Antony at this time. Verse 43, but he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. So the commentary, Octavian got the riches of the Ptolemies by defeating Antony and Cleopatra and seizing their wealth. Now he's talking about Herod the Great once again, verse 44. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many, he says here. Herod the Great, at the end of his life, was greatly troubled and angered by tidings from east and north. And, of course, he did the whole kingdom of Judah no good whatsoever. Verse 45, and he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. The commentator says, Herod the Great presumed to plant his palace on the holy mountain of God, but he came to a lonely end. Okay, so this is the close history interpretation of Daniel chapter 11. Okay.
Well, right, but if you look at the abomination of desolation being set up in the holy place, as Christ still sees it in the future, and I'm not saying that there can't be two interpretations of it.
Yeah.
However, we only see in the New Testament in Matthew that it's still in Christ's future,
mm-hmm.
and something we're looking that's looking to be set up.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that's actually set, I mean, from the time of Christ, Jerusalem's torn down. Nothing's set up. Okay? And nothing's set up until that Temple Mount Mosque is set up. Or it may not even be on the Temple Mount. It's on a different, it's on the wrong hill.
Right.
I don't know. There's all sorts of arguments about where the Temple Mount was even.
Well, Herod built many temples. You know, he actually built a whole city called Caesarea. And it might this might actually be referring to his attempt to rebuild, you know, or continue. He built a huge portion in Jerusalem.
And to understand that interpretation the way you're presenting it,
mm-hmm.
we have to imagine that there's more than one abomination of desolation, which is also possible, but there would have to be more than one.
Well, I mean, the word abomination that maketh desolate, you know, again, back in verse 31, refers to Antiochus Epiphanes, according to verse.
Well, right, but what I'm saying is that Christ uses the same terms.
Yes.
In Matthew 24:15-16.
Right, and that would be the Jews.
And
the
well,
Jews
well
the
no,
temple.
Because he says when you see it standing in the holy place.
Oh, okay, so in the future, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no doubt
that Christ's future.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the Jews today are trying. They want to tear down the two mosques and build a third temple. There's no doubt that they want to do that.
I think that this abomination of desolation that Christ may be referring to, and it fits in with more with my interpretation of Daniel,
mm-hmm.
is the mosque that's there now. I forget
okay.
the name of it.
Yeah,
I forget the name of it, but I'm glad I don't have that idol's name on my lips.
The Al-Aqsa.
Yeah, whatever it is. It's
Al-Aqsa.
An abomination.
Ali oxen free, right? Okay.
And the verses 32, you know, such that do wickedly against the covenant and they that understand among the people and fall by the sword and make their garments white. Mm-hmm. That could describe just as well the Reformation.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't doubt that there is a long-term solution to these prophecies at all.
All right.
Yeah.
Verse 36, and the king shall do according to his will and exalt himself and speak marvelous things against the God of gods. And that could very well describe the popes.
Right. 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 So anyway, unfortunately, there's no author cited for this article. That's why I didn't know his name. Okay. So I'm going to click out of this and go back to the chat room. Okay. So very good. That covers chapter 11. Now let's get into Daniel chapter 12.
Now let me say that verse 40 on, where you describe the conquest of the Near East by Augustus.
Uh-huh.
Those same verses can describe the conquest of the Near East by the British.
Okay.
And Edom and Moab and the children of Ammon also escaped out of the hands of the British.
Mm-hmm.
Because the British appointed them all as sheiks.
Right.
Over the.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, they didn't destroy the people. They only took over the land.
Right. And we'll get into that because the British Israel movement claims that, what's his name? Al-Anabi, General Allenby, was the fulfillment of one of these prophetic, you know, times. It's either 1260 or 1290, but we'll get to that. Right.
Now after I explain my interpretation of this, and I'm not signing my name to it because even though a lot of it seems to make sense,
mm-hmm.
but it would take me a long time to study the whole thing completely.
Yeah, yeah.
And to check its veracity, but
right.
a lot of it seems to make perfect sense.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that it's the struggle between those opposing forces in the European world, you know, in the Mediterranean world. And I count, when I say European world at that time, I mean all of North Africa and the Near East are actually the white world
right.
at that time.
Right.
It seems to be the struggle between the opposing forces
yeah.
and which one would prevail.
Well, no, and you know, that would be a worthy endeavor. For example, I did the same thing with my article, Revelation Unfolded, Part 1, in which, you know, I tried to compare every prophetic statement in the book of Revelation with a historical development, okay? And that took a couple of years, you know, to rule this out and rule that in, rule that out, rule this in, you know, and you really have to study a lot of history. And, of course, the book of Revelation, the latter pages and much of the middle pages are talking about European history. There's no doubt about it, you know. And so, but this may dovetail, these prophecies may dovetail with Revelation as many other Daniel prophecies dovetail with Revelation, you know.
Right. Well, Clinton said something that made a lot of sense to me when I explained this to him, and he mentioned that it sounded like it's describing one little horn, that in Daniel 7,
uh-huh.
fighting with another little horn, that in Daniel 8. You know, the struggle between the king of the north and the king of the south, you know, seemed to parallel that closely.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right. So shall we continue with chapter 12?
Sure.
Yeah, very good. All right. Now, verse 1. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for, too much champagne, which stands for the children of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never once since there was a nation, even to that same time, and at the time your people shall be delivered, everyone that shall be found written in the book. Now, virtually everybody I know of interprets this as, of course, before the judgment day.
Well, this has to be parallel to Revelation 19.
Okay.
You know, 18 and 19 and the talk about the judgment day and the book opening
right.
of the book of life. And Michael, it's, you know, some people interpret that as a separate, distinct
mm-hmm.
Archangel or
right.
however you want to say it.
Mm-hmm.
However, other people interpret this as a reference to Christ himself.
Yeah, at the second coming, right.
Yes, and this is... It's actually also Revelation 12:7, and to interpret it there, we would have to interpret it, I believe, as Yahweh himself, but I don't, you know, it doesn't, neither interpretation is really important to me.
Yeah. And then it says, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. Now, a lot of people would like to start this time of trouble with World War I. And say, well, we've been having a world war ever since, you know, ever since, what year did it begin? 1914.
Well, yeah, right. But that doesn't start a world war. I mean, if you want to see that we've been having one contiguous war since 1914, well, what about the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars and the American Civil War? It's all part of the same war.
Mm-hmm.
It's the war that started in Genesis 3:15.
That's right.
That's when it started.
That's right. That's right. You could say modern warfare, you know, with airplanes and bombs and what have you, you know.
Well, right. But, yeah. I mean, in some ways, modern warfare is more humane than
right.
Yeah, you know, I mean, our English and Scottish ancestors, they hacked each other on the field with scythes and pitchforks.
Oh, yeah, right, right.
Yeah, I'd rather take a bomb any day.
Right. But here I agree with the general interpretation that this is referring to the Judgment Day, you know, or that period just before.
Well, I believe that this is referring to the Judgment Day.
Mm-hmm.
And if we ever needed a time for Michael
prepared.
To stand up for his people,
we need it now. We need it now, exactly. Verse 2, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Now, didn't Paul say exactly the same thing? He is, I didn't realize it until now, he is actually quoting Daniel 12:2.
Well, right, and you know, in the Revelation, there's the city of Yahweh is described descending from heaven,
mm-hmm.
and it said, and this is after all of the enemies, all of the children of the devil, go into the lake of fire.
Right.
Everybody not written in the Book of Life are in the lake of fire already.
Right.
Okay, and
right.
after the city of God descends from heaven, we still have dogs and whoremongers.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of the gates.
Outside the gates, yes, yes.
And
but there will not be.
And they
in
can't
the
be Edomites and Canaanites
mm-hmm.
because the Edomites and Canaanites they're destroyed.
They're definitely destroyed. Yes,
they're gone. They're to be no more.
Obadiah and Zechariah confirm that there shall be no more the Canaanites.
Right, and so do you know the lake of fire in 18 and 19 in Revelation, and the parable of the wheat and the tares, and the parable of the goats and the sheep. In other words, we're going to have, I believe that every Israelite shall be preserved, and that's the word translated saved, and every Adamic soul shall be preserved.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But some of them will wish they'd have done better in this
life. Right, he's going to turn up the heat. Yahweh's going to turn up the heat.
Well, right, and I don't think that it's going to be a state of eternal punishment,
mm-hmm.
but I believe that it's
contempt, not punishment. Right.
Yeah, you know, it says everlasting contempt,
yeah.
and it's going to be a less honorable existence.
That's right. That's right. Verse 3, and they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. And I would hope that that's referring to us, okay, us Christian Israelites who understand that all of this prophecy is about to be fulfilled within our lifetimes. I would think within our, at least in the very near future.
Well, that's part of our hope right now. Yeah,
that's right. That's part of our hope. Yeah.
I think if it goes on another 100 years, we
yeah,
should
be very
probably
bad.
Get too upset.
Those days need to be shortened.
it depends on how much of a remnant we want to hope that Yahweh will have.
Right. Yeah.
The last time it was only 8, right?
Yeah,
so.
It was only 8. Well, I mean, if we take Revelation literally, it'll only be 144,000, okay, which is a very small percentage of the world's population of Israelites, right? Very small percentage, okay? But, yeah, and I don't think we're flattering ourselves when we consider ourselves the ones to be wise and the rest of Judaic Christianity to simply not perceive what's going on. They're just not perceiving it at all. They actually think the Jews are God's chosen people, and they're waiting for the Antichrist yet to come, okay, as we talked about with regard to Daniel chapter 9, okay?
Well, right, but just having the knowledge that we imagine to have isn't enough.
No, it's not.
I mean, it's what you do with it that's important.
Right.
It's, you know, you want to be the servant that received 10 minas and went out and earned 10 minas.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be the servant that received one miner and hit
right.
it in the ground.
All those parables have a very prophetic meaning. Yes, they do. Yes. Okay, verse 4. But you, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end. And it has to be the judgment day. But doesn't mean that these upcoming days' prophecies mean, you know, right up to the day of judgment. Let me start again, verse 4. But you, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book. Even to the time of the end, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. So as we began this entire series with this verse, Daniel 12:4, that our attempt here is to unseal the book of Daniel to provide understanding of it, and obviously generations before us have not had available to them all the history that you and I have been discussing, okay? So they did not have this advantage and, you know, the research material that are available to us, including the archaeology that confirms these things, you know? Generations before our time did not have this available to them.
Well, right, and that's right, but I have one caveat,
okay.
And that's that the people at the time of Christ had to understand Daniel chapter 9. And
mm-hmm.
to some degree, they were anticipating the coming of a Messiah.
Absolutely.
Somehow there was a remnant of people at the time of Christ who were awaiting their redemption.
Yes.
And most people weren't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people were out partying with the Edomites.
Oh, exactly. Well, the same thing applies today.
Well, yeah, that's the illusion I'm trying to make.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
But even at the time, and there's a lot they didn't know, and that's absolutely true. But they somehow, and they seem to have more books than we have.
Yeah.
I mean, the Magi knew about the birth of Christ from a star, right?
Right.
Well, that's nowhere in the Old Testament. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's nowhere you're going to get that from the Old Testament.
Of course.
As
not.
We know the Old Testament today.
Right. Yeah. And then there's many books that have disappeared that are
But even the woman at the well in Samaria, and she had to be an Israelite woman, but she knew that I know Messiah cometh, and when he comes, he shall teach us all things.
Yes. Yeah. But the final phrase here of verse 12, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Every interpreter I've ever read says, well, it's talking about our days, you know, with knowledge and science being increased and archaeology, what have you.
Well, absolutely, but it could also be knowledge of
the scriptures.
Of the scriptures.
Yeah.
And let me just say one thing real quick. That woman at the well in Samaria,
mm-hmm.
she was probably the only Ephraimite in the whole Bible.
Right.
In the whole New Testament.
Well, okay, right. in all of Samaria, right. There probably were a few others.
No, I mean mentioned in the New Testament.
Oh, mentioned, right, okay. All right, verse 5, then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two, the one on this side of the bank of the river, and the other on that side of the bank of the river, and I simply interpret this as being the Old Testament and the New Testament after, you know, after the sacrifice of Christ. Have you got any more to add to that, or a different perspective on verse 5?
On verse 5,
yeah.
Then I, Daniel, looked, and he's looking from one, well, I mean, you could make that allusion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it, if you want to draw a poetic comparison.
Right, but do you have a different perspective or a different interpretation of it? Verse 5?
No.
Okay. All right, verse 6. And one said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? Okay, so apparently asking, well, how long before the judgment day? Verse 7, and I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven, and he swore by him that lives forever that it shall be for a time, times and half, and when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. Okay, so what do you have for us here on verse 7?
Well, it's, you know, this seems to be another occurrence of the 3.5 times.
That's right.
Okay, and if it's already started, you know, then it's parallel with the period of punishment for the deportations.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be,
right.
It may well be a different 3.5 time period. Yeah, you know, the judgment of Yahweh does not come. It we can imagine it tarrying.
Yes.
It was almost 40 years between the crucifixion and the time that Jerusalem was judged.
Yeah, the destruction of the temple, right.
Yeah, you know, and I imagine that we're going to have that 40-year lag time
mm-hmm.
that now in this day and age.
Right.
But this time, times and a half, from the time that Daniel has to be writing this, it can't be any later than like 538 B.C.
Okay, yes.
So 3.5 times is about up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 2520, ended
right.
30
it would,
years ago.
Yeah, it would be, from Daniel, it would be a very early, what about less than 1000 AD could be, and most of the interpretations I'm familiar with refer to one of the mosques, as we've been discussing.
Well, 3.5 times from this time, 2520 years.
Okay.
Not 1260.
Right. The total. Right. Yeah. So if you start from,
so this ended 10 years ago or 30 years ago. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, if you add 1260 and 1290 from 539 BC, that's a total of 2550, and that equals 2012 AD.
Well, right, but why would I add 1260 and 1290?
Well, because they're both mentioned here. Let's see, verse 8.
Well, no. We're talking about verse 7, though.
Right, okay.
A time times and a half would infer 3.5 times.
Right.
Or 2,520 years. And I'm trying to say 2,520 years is past already.
Well, yeah, if we take that from 745 B.C., which was the first seven times prophecy.
Well, even if we take it from the time Daniel wrote this in 538.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's past already.
Yes. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely past. Okay. And I heard, but I understood not. Then I said, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Okay. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Okay. And obviously, this comparison of history and prophecy that we're doing, you can't understand any of this unless you're making an attempt to compare the prophecies with actual history.
Well, right, with actual events.
Yeah, with actual events. And none of the Judeo-Christian denominations are doing any such thing. It's all mere speculation. It's nothing but guesswork.
Yeah. And most of that guesswork stopped over 100 years ago.
Right, right. Now it's just flattery.
Well, what, you know, most of these Judeo-Christian denominations and all the writings that I've seen, their interpretation of the prophecy is based on writers of the 16, 17, 1800s,
mm-hmm.
and they stopped there.
Right.
I don't know if anybody's writing new interpretations.
Yeah, no, only us in Christian Identity.
In the Judeo-Christian world, except for maybe Tim LaHaye.
Yeah, right. The rapture theory.
well, right. And I'm just making a joke with that because, you know, his work is based on the work of the 14th
right.
century Jesuit monk, Rivera,
yeah.
too.
No, and that confirms my point that the modern Judeo-Christian world has utterly given up any attempt to compare history with these prophecies.
Right.
Utterly given up. They're not trying at all.
It's all gone. They're just waiting for the rapture.
Yeah, right. They're all waiting to be raptured. or many of them assuming that they're already in heaven, you know, and they think this is heaven.
Yeah, well, that's a really sick thought.
Yeah, right.
That's
really
a
is.
Trick,
this
ain't
is heaven.
It?
I don't want any. Right.
If this is heaven, God's a practical joker.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay, and verse 11, and from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Now, the British Israel interpretation of this is that from one of the mosques, whether it's the Al-Aqsa Mosque or the Dome on the Rock, I forget which one it is.
Dome of the Rock, that's the one I'm
Dome
trying to remember
Rock.
The name of.
That, 1,290 from that event, is the day that General Allenby marched into Jerusalem and liberated it from the Turks.
Well, I notice a later date for Muhammad's you know, taking a Mecca.
Uh-huh.
But Muhammadism really started probably about 612 A.D.
Right.
Or in there. And Adam Clark, who wrote his commentary in up until about 1831, he even wants to start counting this.
Mm-hmm.
He saw that abomination of desolation as the Dome of the Rock.
Right.
And he wants to start counting this then.
Okay.
And 1335, yeah. from 612 comes to 1947 A.D.
Okay.
Now the 1290, of course, would fall 45 years short of that, 1902.
Right.
But that was also, you know, the loss of, and the Russo-Japanese Wars, the loss of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to have set off a chain of events,
yeah.
which was the most murderous period in recent history, and probably in European history as a whole.
Yeah.
And it was also... It marked the beginning of the complete Edomite takeover of Europe.
Right, right. Yeah, definitely the Edomite Jews of the Soviet Union, you know, they were living in the Pale of Russia at the time, and 90% of them were communists, okay? They were hounding the czars of Russia, assassinating them, assassinating their officers and government officials constantly. And then their first attempt at revolution was in 1905, okay? So that a 1902 could very well be referenced to that. But the British Israel people cite that it took the Dome of the Rock so many years to be completed, okay, and so that their completion date is 1,290 years before General Allenby marched into Jerusalem. That's their reckoning, okay? And I didn't have time to look up the completion of the Dome on the Rock, otherwise I'd have an exact date for you, okay?
Right, but I've seen that. It's in that book, As Birds Flying, and a couple other British Israel books, and that they bring it to 1917.
Right, yeah, that's when.
But they see the Edomite takeover of Judea as a good thing.
Right.
The British Israel people.
Yeah,
they're really sick.
Yeah, that is sick. I can see it as the fact that an Israelite nation, namely Britain, took over Jerusalem at that time. But then in 1947, what happened? They handed it over to the Jews.
Yes, they did. And that's why this, you know.
And there's your 1335.
Right. There's your 1335.
Right. Okay.
Roughly 1947. 1947 is really only a year off.
Right. Well, the UN, by resolution, created the Israeli state on November 29th, 1947. And then about 6 months later, they had a so-called constitution. And our president.
And the question everybody would have is why are we still here talking about that?
Right. Yeah. Why haven't we cast them out to drift long ago? Yeah.
Well, why hasn't this all culminated, you know?
Yeah. Right. Well, because the Judgment Day prophecy hasn't happened yet. Okay. So, but I think we can interpret Daniel chapter 12 as saying all these things must come to pass before the Judgment Day. Okay. Just as there's many verses in the book of Revelation that say these things must come to pass before the second coming. Okay, so let me just read verses 12 and 13, because we already mentioned the 1335 days. Blessed is he that waits and comes to the 1,305 and 30 days, which would be 1947. But go you your way till the end be, for you shall rest and stand in your lot at the end of the day. So the 1335 days is not the end. It's clearly saying that. So there's still a period of time before the creation of the Jew-Israeli state and the Judgment Day. So what have we got? We've got at least 60 years. You know? Now, this is what this is telling us. That, everybody assumes that the Jews are God's chosen people, Israel, and that 1948 was this glorious fulfillment of biblical prophecy. No, it wasn't, folks. What we're being told here is that the day that the Jew-Israeli state was created is an abomination, and that there will be a little bit of time left before the very end. Right? Make sense to you, Bill?
Absolutely.
Very good.
Well, yeah, it's absolutely an abomination.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
That I think that fulfills Malachi, where it says that they will build up, but I will throw down.
Right.
In the opening verses of the book of Malachi.
Yeah, and in the book of Second Esdras, the three-headed eagle prophecy, I don't know if people had a chance to read that, one of the verses talks about a small nation full of trouble. Okay.
Well, what right, but there's, you know, first, Jeremiah says that Jerusalem will, just like this clay vessel that he breaks, Jerusalem will be broken forever and never be put back together again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how could any Judeo-Christian read, I think it's Jeremiah chapter 18 or 19, how could any Judeo-Christian read that? How could anybody read that and imagine that Jerusalem could be put back together again?
That's right.
It was broken in 70 AD. I mean, it took a long time for Jeremiah's prophecy to become fulfilled. But once it's broke, how could it be fixed?
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, the literal city of Jerusalem will not be fixed. It will not be fixed. And most people in Judeo-Christianity simply do not. In fact, this is true of British Israel as well, that they do not consider the possibility that the word Jerusalem prophetically and symbolically means us, the children of Israel. Okay.
Right.
And not the literal city.
Malachi 1:4 says, whereas Edom saith, we are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places.
There you go.
Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, they shall build, but I will throw down.
That's right.
And they shall call them the border of wickedness.
Uh-huh.
Now, what land meets that description except Israel?
Well, they even built a wall between themselves and the Palestinians, didn't they?
Well,
it's
right.
A border of wickedness.
It's certainly not the wall of the land of unwalled villages.
That's right. That's right. So everything here points to the Jew-Israeli state, pseudo-Israel, being the abomination of desolation. As, you know, we have interpreted this, you know, when I first got into identity, I understood that. Okay. You know, but the British Israelites, assuming, as the rest of the Judeo-Christian world does, that the Jews are a part of the tribe of Judah, they assume that the Jews are actually Judah, and that therefore they agree with the rest of the Judeo-Christian world that, you know, this is God's doing. Okay? The Israeli state is God's doing. Folks, that's absurd. That's absurd. Not one good thing has happened in Palestine since the Jews invaded. Not one good thing. They've made treaty after treaty after treaty and broken all of them. They have used the possession of Palestine as, you know, and of course the Holocaust to extort from Germany, Britain, and America payments to prop up their state, which otherwise would collapse in an instant, okay? We've seen the world being debauched and wars upon wars upon wars after the creation of the Israeli state, because the United Nations and the Israeli state are simply part of the same Rothschild scheme. Okay, hyping up the Jews, the Jewish people, and turning them all into Zionists so that they antagonize every other country in which they live, including America, because the Jewish Zionists do not have any loyalty to America whatsoever. The Jewish Zionists have no loyalty to Great Britain whatsoever, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So the creation of the Israeli state has been nothing but trouble. Nothing but trouble for the whole planet since it was created.
Well, let me quote Adolf Hitler.
Okay.
Page 184, Mein Kampf. When the Zionists try to make the rest of the world believe that the new national consciousness of the Jews will be satisfied by the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine, the Jews thereby adopt another means to dupe the simple-minded Gentile.
Yes.
They have not the slightest intention of building up a Jewish state in Palestine to live in it.
Right.
What they really are aiming at is to establish a central organization for their international swindling and cheating. As a sovereign state, this cannot be controlled by any of the other states. Therefore, it can serve as a refuge for swindlers who have been found out, and at the same time a high school for the training of other swindlers.
The oligarchs.
That's exactly what it's become.
Mm-hmm.
It's a haven for international criminals.
Right, and for sexual slavery.
And Hitler had them pegged.
He absolutely did. Absolutely did. Organ harvesting. It's just an abomination. The Israeli state is nothing but an abomination. There's not one good thing you can say about it. One good thing.
And basically, Daniel's not about the Israeli state. It's about the Messiah and the people of Israel.
Well, of course it is. Yeah. Yeah. The Messiah, the Prince. You can't mistake that for the Antichrist. But they do. They do. They try to interpret it as the Antichrist.
I think we deconstructed that here. I just don't know how we're going to get Judeo-Christians to listen to it.
Because they're so brainwashed by the Jews are God's chosen people idea that they can't consider any other alternative. You know, they're just going to have to learn the hard way that they've been backing the Antichrist instead of the Christ. You know, they're just going to have to learn the hard way. And, you know, so I feel sorry for them. Going back to chapter 12, verse 1, let me repeat this, folks. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation even to that same time. And that at that time your people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. Okay? So we, we're getting ready for a very, very serious time of trouble. It's going to get far worse. We're just seeing the beginning of it with the collapsing economy. We're going to see starvation. We're going to see blood in the streets. We're going to see total revolution worldwide. That's what we're going to see. And plus earthquakes and possibly, meteors and who knows what else. You know, this is going to be very, very serious stuff. So we have to prepare ourselves mentally, spiritually, and physically. Come out of Babylon. Yes, two nations are in thy womb, he said to Rebekah, and one of them was the Edomites, became known as the Edomites, yes. Okay, very good. Bill, I think we've done about as good a job as could possibly be done in terms of interpreting the book of Daniel and explaining it. And in essence, as verse 4 says, but you, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even till the time of the end, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Of course, knowledge has been increased, but wisdom and understanding have not. In fact, all the knowledge of the universities has simply made the graduates simple-minded, okay, and brainwashed them into thinking that there's peace when there is no peace. Right?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not supposed to be peace.
Yeah, right.
I've come not to bring peace, but a sword.
But a sword, yeah. And that sword is going to manifest itself at this judgment day, and I believe very, very soon, within the next 2 or 3 years.
And white Christians are never going to have peace until they learn that Christians are white.
That's right. Exactly right. To defend their own race and people and culture. If they're not prepared to do that, they will be cut down just like the Edomites will. And we're seeing that already. We're seeing that already because if you make common cause with the Edomites, then you will be judged with the Edomites. That's the prophecy of the wheat and tares. It says exactly that. Don't allow your roots to be entangled with the roots of the tares. But that's what Judeo-Christianity has done. So I see nothing but continuous trouble and increasing trouble for all of the denominations of Judeo-Christianity. If they do not disentangle themselves from the Edomites, they will be judged accordingly. You know, and obviously the reason we're doing this, Bill, is to try to enlighten those Judeo-Christians and get them out of that false belief. That is the false prophet of the book of Revelation. All those who teach that the Jews are God's chosen people and that we have to make common cause with them. That is
the
false prophet.
Oh, they are definitely false prophets. There is no doubt. How could you take the enemies of God, the dispersion of the children of Israel, clearly happened in the Old Testament, Israel and Judah.
Right.
700 years before, well, an average, you could average it out. It happened by 676 B.C., Ephraim was no longer a nation.
Uh-huh.
And most of Judah was deported to the cities of the Medes along with the northern tribes of Israel.
Right. Yeah, so we had all 12 tribes in captivity, yes.
Right, and that was 95% of Israel. That was all Israel except the inhabitants of Jerusalem.
The city of Jerusalem, exactly.
Now that's the dispersion of the children of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And in Luke chapter 19, Christ is talking about the dispersion of the Jews, of
right.
the enemies.
Right.
When he says these people will be cast out into every land and
yeah.
killed by the sword and enslaved. He's talking about the Edomites.
Yes.
That's the dispersion of the Jews.
Yes.
That's what the Jews today look at as their diaspora.
That's right.
They don't look to 700 B.C.
No, of course not.
The Jews of today identify their diaspora.
Those people even still exist.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews of today identify their diaspora as 70 A.D.
That's right.
And both Jeremiah in the parable of the good and the bad figs, and Christ in Luke and his in his discourse on the time of the end, both identified a diaspora of 70 A.D. as the diaspora of the enemies of God.
Right.
Not the diaspora of Israel.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
I don't know how Judeo-Christians can even be confused by that.
Right.
Just read Luke and most of the cross references take mm-hmm. that back to Jeremiah.
That's right. That's right. That's absolutely correct. And, of course, the Judeo-Christian world does not, again, as we said earlier, they don't consider this history. They just had these vague notions of spiritual Israel. Yet they still accept literal Jews as Judah.
And literal Jews are Judea. What, and anybody kind of that confuses the Jews and the Jews in Judah is just an idiot. I mean, there's no doubt.
If you're going to talk about spiritual Israel, why keep talking about literal Jews at all? That doesn't make any sense. You know, absolutely no sense whatsoever. So, I mean, if Israel has become spiritualized, and the Jews obviously are not spiritual in any way, shape, or form, why even talk about them at all? They have nothing to do with it. And as we understand,
but it's very clear that the Jews, the disbelieving Judeans of the New Testament period, aren't even the seed of Jacob. And
that's
they're told
right.
that over and over again.
Uh-huh.
They can't be confused with Judah.
That's
they,
right.
They can't. I'm sorry, it's Luke 21, verse 24.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the diaspora of the bad figs. That's the diaspora of of the evil figs who are today the Jews. That has nothing to do with Judah.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Yes. Okay. Well,
and that's the story, you know, if you compare Luke 21, 24 with Jeremiah 24, 8 and 9.
Uh-huh.
And that's the dispersion of the good and the bad figs.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and it's true, Troublemaker says, the Jews have Judah's blood. That's true.
A lot of them have Ephraim's blood, too.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, you got to be a fool to think that Ephraim wasn't mixing his race. If you read the Old Testament, you'll find it. Ephraim is a cake not turned.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it says in Hosea. Now, what's a cake not turned? It's black on one side. That's what it is.
Right, and white on the other.
You put a cake in a pan and don't turn it and see what happens to it.
Yeah, and a lot of those Ephraimites stayed in Samaria and became known as the Samaritans. They were half-breeds, too. So Judah is not the only guilty one. Ephraim is just as guilty of race mixing.
Well, why was Ephraim divorced?
Right. Ephraim was divorced.
For
Judah
race
was not
mixing.
Divorced. Right. At least that portion of Judah that, you know, as I pointed out in many of my sermons, that the books of Ezra and Nehemiah clearly state that there was a revival, a great revival of the Mosaic Law under Ezra and Nehemiah. They kicked out all the race mixers. That's what they did. They kicked them all out, but that never happened in the 10 northern tribes. They kept race mixing with the Zidonians and the remnant of the Ammonites and the Moabites, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So the Ephraimites are probably more guilty than the Judahites of race mixing.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And race mixing and bull worship and
as a matter of fact, yes.
Pagan fertility cults, the whole thing, the Ephraimites.
Exactly. And there's a prophecy about Ephraim exactly about that Ephraim would be the most guilty of mixing his seed with non-Israelites. Okay? That is, the descendants of Ephraim would pollute themselves, as we're seeing in Great Britain and in America, okay, and in South Africa.
Right, they're polluting themselves today.
They're
all
polluting
the time.
Themselves. That we are Ephraim and Manasseh.
And only a fool stands there and says, "I am without sin."
Right, that's right.
If you claim you have no sin, you're a liar.
Yeah,
that's the scripture.
Yeah, and both houses are guilty, but only the northern house was divorced. Southern house of Judah was not divorced. Of course, it couldn't be divorced.
Well, I could debate that. I think that they were divorced, but nobody, you know, Yahweh says the two families of the earth I have put away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true there's no divorce recorded.
Yeah.
But he says the two families of the earth have I not put away. Put away. And you know, there was nobody around to record Judah's divorce.
Right, right. But, you know, that could still be interpreted as the majority, as you mentioned earlier, 95%.
Well, absolutely.
Of Judah and Benjamin were also taken captive.
Anybody from Judah is, and this is a thing a lot of people miss, anybody of Judah is really of Israel.
That's right.
You know what
right.
I mean?
Exactly, exactly, yeah. We're all Israelites, so, and our people have sinned terribly, and the sin of race mixing is still going on terribly within our people, within our race and nation, and we just have to finally put an end to it once and for all. And we in identity are the only ones teaching that.
And look at what look at who Ahab took for a wife.
Right.
The great king of Ephraim. Who did he take for a wife? Jezebel.
That's right.
And who's nobody's chastised more in the book of Revelation for fornication, which is race mixing,
mm-hmm.
than Jezebel.
Right.
It's explicit. It's right in Revelation. I think it's
chapter 2. Yeah, well, Jezebel is the symbol of our people race mixing. That's what she's a symbol of. Yeah.
Right, and she's an Ephraimite symbol.
Right, yeah. She married Ahab was an Ephraimite. Absolutely, yeah. Okay, very good. What's the plan? Because we were going to plan on starting tomorrow, 2 Corinthians, but you had another idea for tomorrow.
Would really like to put off the 2 Corinthians until January,
Okay.
2nd.
Okay.
And I would like to do a program on Greek exegesis and explaining the shortcomings of translating from a concordance.
Okay.
And what there really is to the parts of speech in the Greek language.
Okay.
And what you have to know in order to be able to translate Greek.
Okay. Okay.
And I would like to talk about that and what to expect from a concordance, what to expect
mm-hmm.
from a lexicon. And I think that that would be
right.
a very useful program.
Right. Well, certainly within that discussion, we could talk about the definition of the word eudaios, which is routinely translated as Jew, but which does not mean modern Jew at all. It means Judean in the sense of a citizen of a country. And the translation, the false use of the word Gentile, things like that would certainly be a part of, the problems that we have with the King James Version and virtually all other versions. They may all
right.
make the same mistakes. Yes. So, okay, so tomorrow we'll be talking about proper translation from the Greek.
Right, Greek okay. translation and exegesis.
Okay, very good, very good. And so then next Friday we will start on John, Book of John, Gospel of John. Is that where we're going?
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Right, Gospel of John Friday.
Okay.
It's concentrating on 2C line, of course.
Right, right. Okay, and then Sunday my guest will be Clay Douglas. We'll be talking about our new book, Mystery Babylon, The New World Order Exposed.
I'm probably not going to show up for Sunday's program.
That's okay. That's okay.
I don't, Clay Douglas, I
know, he was a Paul basher. He's getting better.
No, I want a retraction. I don't want to ruin your program Sunday.
Yeah, okay.
Because if I show up on your program, I'm going
to
demand a retraction.
I know, you're
going
to have an argument with Clay. Okay, very good. But, he has been accepting my explanations of mistranslations of Paul, and he's beginning to see the light.
Well, he's going to get a good chastising from me. he has to print a retraction.
Okay, okay.
He has to publish a retraction of his articles.
Well, yeah, because he published a lot of anti-Paul stuff.
Well, two-thirds of William Fink versus the Paul bashers is about Clay Douglas's articles.
Uh-huh.
And the guy, I think I prove over and over again that the guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, right.
And he followed the Jews, and all
exactly.
the Paul bashers
followed
the
all the
Jews.
Paul bashers do, whether they realize it or not, yes. Very good. Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it was another great, fun program, and I hope we did justice to the book of Daniel, that obviously you're not going to get any such interpretation from the Judeo-Christian world, okay? And we may not understand it all perfectly, but we understand that the real battle is between true Israel and the children of Satan, otherwise known as the Jews. If you don't understand that, you don't know the Bible. And the book of Daniel totally confirms that. It's part of the 2-seed line message. It's a continuation of it. And that's what we're here trying to explain. So I thank you all for listening. And we'll see you tomorrow night on Yahweh's Covenant People. And we'll be talking about the proper translation of the Greek into the modern Bible. Okay? Thank you very much, Bill.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. Yahweh bless you all. And good night.